So this is joint work with David Sherman. And a brief outline of the talk is I want to review what TQFTs are. Then I want to talk about a trace for the annual timber lead category that comes from the TQFT. And then finally, say what this might have to do with three products and three independents. I'm not an operator algebraist at all, so if I say something non-idiomatic about operator algebra or free probability or anything like that, please bear with me. And then there's also, my goal is for this to be a fairly elementary talk, but again, because I'm not familiar with the audience, I might not have a very well-calibrated sense of what elementary is in this context, so please interrupt with questions if you have any. I usually do better talking in response to questions. Okay, so I guess a lot of the talk is going to be about the Templer-Leib type pictures, but it actually works for any planar algebra, any two category with the right properties. So given a planar algebra, what's one thing you can do with it? Well, you can make it non-planar by taking the sort of pictures you would draw on a disk and just draw them on a surface instead. So for Templer-Leib, we start with, a vector space generated by all possible pictures on a surface, and then we divide that by a relation. Is there a point? Yeah, here it is. Let's say two pictures are isotopic, then we regard them as equivalent, and if we've got a loop that doesn't bound anything else, then it's equal to some multiple of the empty picture, where this little d here is the delta from Dietmar's talk. So in other words, we're forming a sort of skein module for any surface y and C, which encodes the boundary conditions, which we hold fixed throughout the discussion, and its pictures are drawn wide modulo some relations. Okay, so what kind of properties? Oh, and so this is an example. This is from a very influential picture of Greg's. This is the relations for a G2 spider planar algebra. I'm not going to talk about this, but it's just to keep in mind that there's more relations than just Templer-Leib. All the rest of the talk I'm going to stick with Templer-Leib, but most of it goes through for any set of relations, including nice ones like this. And yet another example of relations that I won't be concentrating on is typically, or at least the most studied thing in topology, is we take a further quotient. We not only set trivial loops equal to zero, but we pick some integer n, and then we take this this idempotent for the Templer-Leib algebra, and we set it equal to zero. And in order for that to be a consistent relation, we have to insist that the loop value has a form q plus q inverse, where q is the appropriate primitive root of unity. And so for n equals 3, we get this five-term relation, and d would have to be the square root of 2. Now, this one that I just defined with the n, where you have take more relations, that's five-dimensional for all surfaces, and that's what gets studied a lot. And what I want to concentrate on this talk is the bigger space, which is going to be five-dimensional only from the disks, and otherwise you'll get an infinite-dimensional vector space for the surface. And one of the goals is to complete those vector spaces and see how much of the sort of nice theory for these finite dimensional things can be carried over to the infinite dimensional case. So one thing we know with surfaces is glue them together. If we've got a surface and two boundary components have matching boundary conditions, B and B, and then we get this map gluing to the glue surface, we could also glue a surface to itself. And so that ability to glue puts a variety of algebraic structures on these surfaces. It's not just some random collection of vector spaces. They cohere together in various ways, and that's part of the power of the subject of, planar algebras, two categories, etc. So one thing we can do is if we have a surface which is a one manifold across an interval, so there's how many interesting one manifolds do we know? We've got the interval itself in a circle. Given such a thing, we can make a category. So what, in case you're unfamiliar with it, by a category, I need a collection of objects, and that's just going to be some collection of points on the one manifold we started with, either a collection of points on the interval, collection of points on the circle. And the morphisms are going to be the vector space we just defined for the surface cross, I mean, the one manifold cross I, with conditions, you know, A at the bottom and B at the top. Those will be the morphisms from A to B. And then compositions, we just glue the diagrams together. So this is what Dietmar was talking about. And the point is we can do it not just for an interval. That would give us the rectangular temporal lead category. We could also do it for a circle. And we can also do this in other dimensions. So the reason I said a one manifold instead of treating these two cases is that there are applications where, in higher dimensional picture calculus, you can get categories associated to higher dimensional manifolds, and it becomes more interesting. And I'll have a little bit to say at the end of the talk about that if there's time. And again, this, some people get nervous when you say category instead of algebra, but it's really just a very mild generalization of the notion of an algebra. The best example, you'd ask, what's the structure, if you take all finite dimensional matrices of n by n for any m and any n, what structure does that have? Well, sometimes you can multiply things together if the dimensions match up, but not always. And whenever you can multiply, it's associative, and you have identity operators. And so that's, so square matrices, algebra, rectangular matrices, category. And so since we allow non-matching boundary conditions, we get a category instead of an algebra. Okay, so what are these categories good for? One thing we can do is we can glue them onto the boundary of the surface to get an action of the category. So what do I mean by the action of a category? I mean, for every object of the category, I need to associate a vector space. So an object of, say, the annular temporal lead category is some collection of points in the circle. B, so I need to produce a vector, I guess B is C up there. I need to produce a vector space. So I put these same boundary conditions B on the surface that I chose. Look at the vector space there. And then for every morphism of that in the annular temporal lead category, I need a linear map between the appropriate vector spaces. And we get that just by gluing it on. And clearly this is associative. So basically the notion that manifolds have a collar, a neighborhood of the boundary, which is isomorphic to a product, translates into an action in the algebraic setting. So the next thing we want to do, so that what I've talked about so far describes a sort of set of two-dimensional invariants. And we want to find something corresponding to three manifolds, if possible. So that's borrowing physics terminology that's usually called a path integral. And so first I'm going to, and so these path integrals don't always exist for every example of a planar algebra you might start with. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they do partially. That'll be this case. But first let's write down what we expect, if they deserve the name path integral, they need to satisfy some properties. So what are they? Well, first of all, the path integral for a three-manifold M should be some function from the vector space associated to its boundary to, say, the complex numbers or whatever our ground ring is. And it needs to satisfy a gluing formula. To explain what that means, we start out we start over here. Actually, this arrow is going the wrong direction. We start out wanting to evaluate this picture. We've got some picture B drawn on the boundary of our three-manifold M. And we want to express that in terms of M cut open. The path, we want to express the path integral of that thing, which is left-hand side of the equation right there, in terms of the cut open manifold. So once we cut M open, we can cut the boundary condition B as well, and we get a picture. But then, if I were fancy with PowerPoint, these two things would be blank right now, and then I would press a button and magically something would pop in. We can't evaluate the picture on the cut manifold until we fill in the new part of the boundary that's emerged from cutting. And so what do we stick in there? Well, we do the logical thing and we sum over a basis for vector space associated to that data. That data, in this case, being a disk or it could be some other surface with some boundary condition specified. And so then we take the Coven thing, we glue two copies of our basis vector, we evaluate the pattern of the cut manifold on it, and then we correct by a factor of 1 over the, I'm assuming the basis is orthogonal, but I'm not assuming it's orthonormal, so I divide by 1 over EIEI. What, you know, what this really is I'm taking the trace and the dual space to the vector space for the disk. That's why the inverse comes in there, but this form is more computationally convenient. What do I mean by inner products? I haven't mentioned those so far, and we sort of, in a somewhat circular fashion, we define the inner product in terms of the path integral. Inner product of two vectors is defined to be, take the surface cross I as a three manifold, and then we can put one picture A on the top, picture B on the bottom, and evaluate the path integral. So that's what we want. And the question is, does such a thing exist? Let's see. But we're also going to be using this gluing formula to define the trace, so let's look at an example. So a special form, if the three manifold we're evaluating has a form surface cross S1, in particular we're going to be interested in the case disk cross S1, and we evaluate on a picture, then we can simplify this previous gluing formula. This simplifies and take what I'm calling the trace of B cut. Our X of the annular simple lead category, and we have a copy of R for the representations of started 0 points, and then a bunch of circles for each positive integer K. And this has a natural topology and a whole kernel topology, which is the reason for the topology of the obvious parameterization. Okay, so the CQF TGS gives a measure on this. I'm not going to go through the details, but on X0, these are the ones that had the moments, the Catalan numbers, so you get semicircular law. This is something supported in just -2 to 2. And for these others, you get the following. So remember that Q is our loop parameter. It's in a case we're interested in where it's a real number not equal to ±1, so that this B comes out strictly greater than 2. And so this number is always going to be strictly greater than 2. This number in absolute value is less than or equal to 2, so you can see this is positive everywhere. If we had B equal to 2, then we would start to get, you know, something, there's some critical behavior. That's, you know, an interesting case, but it's not the subject of this talk. Obviously this is a very familiar sort of measure of distribution. I don't know whether this one is, you know, so here, you know, these two things are kind of coming up wrapped into one big category structure. So now I'm going to say a little bit about the structure of the annular temporal lead category and how we might take completions of it. So for each object P of the annular temporal lead category, we take one of our representations that we just talked about, and we look at the vector space it assigns to the object P, and that's a finite dimensional vector space. In fact, the dimension is this number right there. And so we want to think of those as giving some kind of smooth vector bundle over our space X. The dimension will vary according to which component of X we're on, but it's smooth, you know, locally it varies smoothly. So we get to each object in the annular temporal lead category, we get a vector bundle, and for each morphism, we get a bundle map between them. So if M goes between P and Q, and there's a continuous bundle map, this is just, you know, all this follows immediately from the definition of representation. So in other words, we have a functor from the annular lead category to the category of vector bundles and bundle maps over the space X, which is the spectrum of the category. and assigns the bundle R sub T, and so now I've left out the index at the top that gave the representation, so I mean the collection of all of them, which fit together to form the bundle, vector bundle, and then we get this bundle map there. Again, for assuming that B is greater than 2, this functor is injective, and this image is dense, and so, and in fact, the space X has a measure on it, so it's, you know, we can do the usual things at this point to complete it. Okay. So, next thing I want to talk about was free independence. So this is inspired, I mean, this is my attempt to take these ideas of Bish and Jones and interpret them in this, you know, this slightly different context. So everything I did for Temple Reed, the first point, which I also made at the very beginning, is it's a very general construction. It could be any sort of planar algebra. It could be the planar algebra. It could be one of these Seuss-Catalan things, different arcs. It could be one of the Kupferberg G2 examples, you know, whatever you want. All those constructions work. And so now I want to recall the definition of a free product of planar algebras. And I think I want to, because I'm not, I think it's worth going over again, because I'm even though under it is very similar to what Dmar said, but there's maybe some superficial differences. There was a remark in the questions that a free product of groups just means you take the generators from both groups and you allow yourself to combine them any way you want to, and you pose no additional relations. And that's one way of looking at it here. If we have a planar algebra with only one color, then we just allow ourselves to draw pictures and strands coming from any of our, say, three input algebras, and these different colors never interact. But we can also think of it, I just want to say a little bit, but what would you do if you did have, say, colors in the regions, or two colors or more colors? And then, you know, we think, what's a free product of groupoids? Well, suppose we have some space A and a different space B, and then we consider the fundamental groupoids, in other words, objects or points in the space, and we just consider paths and composition paths. Then we're going to take the free product here. It should be the one-point wedge of the spaces, but we have to pick a point, you know, some point in A and some point in B, and we identify those two points. And so if I redraw the picture, it looks like this. And that would be free. If we had chosen to identify more than one point, you know, that wouldn't be a free product anymore. It would be something more complicated. If we had chosen a subspace greater than point, it would be a free product with amalgamation. There are questions about that. And so what we're doing here, in some ways, is exactly analogous to that. One interesting example of a planar algebra, two categories, you just take the space of maps of disks into spaces, and then in that case, this definition of free product in a more common foil way would correspond exactly to the one-point union of spaces. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that this isn't, you might think that this definition is something we've cooked up because we know the answer we want to get at the end of the day is free product of non-commutative probability spaces. But in fact, that's not the case. You know, this definition makes a lot of sense even if you are not interested at all about traces or non-commutative probability. So I want to make a statement just about the this only a piece of the annular category, and just these morphisms going from zero strands to zero strands, which in fact is just a disguised version of the fusion algebra that Dietmar was talking about. And so we've got this A00 algebra of planar algebra number 1, composed of green strands, planar 2, blue strands, planar 3, purple strands, and then we have the thing for the free product where we just have strands of any colors mixed in any way we want to. And now that we have a TKL trace, all all three of these things become non-commutative probability spaces. And then, so the claim is that that the A00 algebra of the free product and planar algebras is equal to the free product in the sense of, I guess, Euler-Lescu of these non-commutative probability spaces. And that's, again, very similar to the result of Bish and Jones. The proof is actually very simple, and it gets into these free cumulants and things like that, so it's a nice tie-in. So I thought I'd also, since the talk's going fast, and I thought I'll go through it in a little bit of detail. Okay, so how do we prove that? So we want to calculate a trace of a picture like this. So I'm thinking of this, if you like, I've got elements lowercase a1, 2, 3, and 4, each of which is from one of my, say, three planar algebras. And we know by the definition of the TQFT trace, that's just the dimension of all diagrams which start with, you know, this same sequence of strands on the outside of the disk, and where the shaded part of the disk means we fill in with anything we want. So we can calculate this trace, this mixed moment, if you like, just by computing the dimension of that space. Okay, so here the notation gets a little sloppy, so I need to, so I claim that dimension, this big dimension, can be written as a sum over non-crossing partitions. So what I mean, so this orange, if orange is the new white, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is, given some picture in a disk, and we've got various planar things coming out, and these are grouped in various ways. Maybe this is my A1, A2, A3, A4. We can ask outside of the A's, but still in all the A's that are white, that aren't part of a strand. So that would be everything here, and it would be everything in here. But we're not allowed to cross any strands, and so we end up with a partition of things, you know, where these two got grouped together and these two were separated. And so any picture you draw determines something like that. And so we can take, if we have a basis, we can just organize our, you know, instead of something all over all basis vectors, we can organize them by these, you know, you should think of these thick chalk lines as being, that's what I've tried to draw on the orange here. So here's a picture where it's a very simple partition. Yeah, it's the complementary partition. Yeah, so here, yeah, so these are two, an extremal case, right here. Now, there's a little technicality that, because these, you might ask, you know, how do I know that these two things are connected? Maybe the relation in my planar algebra allows me to rewrite this picture in terms of one where there's nothing there, in which case I could go across like that. And so what you really have to do is to take the dimension of all these things right here and subtract off the dimension of the ones that are expressible where they're separated. So I'm lying a little bit here when I'm saying that's just the dimension of something. Okay, so here are some examples of the terms. You know, we could look for pictures, you know, we're summing over all orange complementary partitions of diagrams which, you know, are complementary to that partition. But the whole point of one thing is, because it, I mean, this is exactly sort of, you know, one, you can take this as a definition of a free cumulant. If in the partition lattice the answer for the big thing is a sum over things below it, that says that there's a cumulant relation. And then by definition of the free thing, we never have pictures where blue joins to green, so that these dimensions will always be zero. So it sort of follows very immediately that from the definition of a planar algebra, that from this point of view, the free cumulants are always zero, therefore we get the free product thing. Okay, so the only slide I have left is slide to remind me of other things to talk about if I finish too early, which I think I have. Okay, so so what does this mean? The first one is that it's not really the subject of this talk or this conference, but one of the motivations for taking these completions of the annular temporal deed categories, you want to understand the finite dimensional versions as for the large unit limit. And so we have this loop parameter D, sort of a big unsolved problem in mathematical topological quantum field theories is to prove, you know, there's this physics proof of Wiggins that just gives a large end behavior of these finite dimensional things, what I call the A-prime sub n. And that's like letting the loop parameter approach D from below. So in other words, it's two cosines of K.
So then I come to the next question. So if the U2PQFT that you wrote down for bigger K, does that make sense? Can you give a closed expression in terms of data associated with the Baynard? The formula you had Q to the K plus Q to the minus K plus minus 1 to the K minus 1 and Q to the
Oh, can I do that for other planar algebras?
Yeah.
I haven't worked out it's sort of a computational problem, so I don't claim that I can easily write down for any planar algebra the analogs for this. On the other hand, I don't think it's like some intractable problem. I think in the examples that are a little bit more complicated than temporal deed, and with a little bit more work, you can get a similar answer, but I haven't worked that out. And I will say that if you're dealing with a planar algebra which is like a quantized Lie group, in the way that, the temporal Lie corresponds to SU2, then this space X should be replaced by you take the full root lattice of the Lie algebra crossed with its dual Lie, so it's going to be some k-dimensional lattice, for rank k, it's going to be some k-dimensional lattice across the k-dimensional torus, and then we divide out by the Weyl group. And so this space can be thought of as Z cross S1 modulo an involution. This becomes just an interval when we do there. So that's, I think, the conjecture for what the answer would look like for a general Lie group, what the space of Europe would look like. And then PQFT should give some kind of interesting measure on that space. But I haven't worked that out.
Is there a tensor
structure
on this tensor category of
tensor? It's a braided. It turns out to be a braided category, braided tensor category. Is that?
Well, the regular tensor category is, but this annular one.
The annular.
Yeah, no, it's a braiding by sticking in pairs of. I think there is a. It's like the annular one's like the quantum double of the rectangular one, right? Yes, I mean, for the structure, I think there's some, so roughly the idea, maybe I'll describe in terms of representations of the, if I have, say this is some representation, I'll draw it as a surface of the annular temporal deep category, and here's another representation, then I can combine them by gluing on a pair of pants, we get some combined representation of these two things here. And because the mapping class group of the pairing pants has these braiding relations, you get, not a commuted tensor category, but a braided tensor category.